But first, Noah Hawley. He's the man behind one of the most audacious adaptations of all time. Noah transformed the Coen brothers' beloved 1996 thriller Fargo into the FX anthology series. The series takes place in the same universe as the film, but carves out its own storytelling territory. We caught up with Noah while he was shooting season 4 to talk about his companion making-of book called Fargo. This is a true story. The book's subtitle plays off the famous declaration that opens the film and each episode of the series.
You know, what I loved about the film and its use of that introduction was that the moment that you say something is real, you open yourself up to randomness and coincidence. You know, when I sat down with the network in pitching this idea to them, I said, we have to figure out what is our Mike Yanagita. Mike Yanagita was the character in the movie who went to high school with Marge and called her up out of the blue, and they had this lunch together, and he told her about the girl from high school that they fell in love, and they got married, and she died of leukemia, and he's just so lonely.
Oh, and then I saw you on the TV, and I remembered, you know, I always liked you.
Well, I always liked you,
I always liked you so much.
So, Mike, should we get together another time, you think?
No, I'm sorry. It's, you know, I shouldn't have done this. I thought we'd have a really terrific time.
It's okay, Mike.
You were such a super lady. And then I've been so lonely.
And then later you find out that that's a lie, that the woman actually has a restraining order against this guy. And you think, why is this in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with the story at all, except on some level it adds to the truthiness of it, because you think, well, the only reason they put that in is because it actually happened.
Mm.
You know, it's just part of the real story. So on some level for me, as I break these stories and figure out what should happen in them, you know, there's a lot of conversations that I have with the writers that I work with where I'll say, you know, that's a great twist, but it's a movie twist. It's what you would see in a movie. I'm looking for those moments of random collision, you know, which is why the show has so many moving pieces on a collision course, is because at that point you really don't know which ones are going to collide and when. And when you do that, you undermine the sort of Western black hat versus white hat tropes that everyone always does.
Mm-hmm. Your book features interviews with many of the actors you worked with over the first 3 seasons, including Billy Bob Thornton, who played Lorne Malvo in the first season. And during your conversation, Billy Bob said that you managed to make a new thing out of something that was revered and yet keep what the thing was that was revered. How did you manage to pull that off?
No, I don't necessarily know how I did it or hopefully continue to do it. These stories always start with a kind of premise. It's two men meet in an emergency room, and one of them is a very civilized man, and the other is the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
That then fuels questions, well, who are these men, and what happens next? Or a woman drives home with a man sticking out of her windshield and makes dinner for her husband, and you think, okay, well, who's the guy in the windshield, and what happens next? You know, there's a certain degree in which those premises arise, and I think, well, that feels like a Coen Brothers premise, a setup, and then obviously it's all in the execution. You know, I had a lot of conversations very early in going from script to screen with FX in which they tried to remind me that I wasn't making a comedy, and I said, well, I think we're having the wrong conversation, because Fargo is really the tension between comedy and tragedy. You know, what I feel goes into that filmmaking approach that Joel and Ethan have is that they do a lot of things that are really funny to them that aren't meant to be comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So the best example is Javier Bardem's haircut in No Country for Old Men. You know, I know that they cut his hair like that and they laughed at his face for like 30 minutes. But there's nothing funny about it in the movie. It's just this sort of very specific and unsettling detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Billy Bob also told you that people come up to him all the time and say, my God, that character in Fargo is literally the best character I've ever seen on TV. And they're going beyond saying that Lorne Malvo is the best villain they've ever seen on TV.
You step out of the car, please, sir.
How old's your kid?
He said, step out of the car.
Dad, come in. Dad, over.
Let me tell you what's going to happen. Officer Brimley, I'm going to roll my window up, then I'm going to drive away. And you're going to go home to your daughter. And every few years, you're going to look at her face and know that you're alive because you chose not to go down a certain road on a certain night. That you chose to walk into the light instead of into the darkness. Do you understand me? Sir. I'm rolling up my window.
It raises the question, what is it that makes Lorne Malvo such a compelling character?
We like Lorne Malvo because we know exactly what he is from the first time that we see him. We hate Lester because when we meet Lester, he's wearing human clothes. And he tricks us into feeling empathy for him, and then he turns out to be a monster of equal proportion. But since he tricked us, we hate him for it. I think there's a really interesting dynamic there in which Billy's character is allowed to be the villain you love to hate, you know, whereas Lester, there's no love there in the end.
Yeah. And wasn't the character of Lorne based on a Richard Matheson story?
There was a Richard Matheson story. That wasn't the inspiration for the character originally, but it was something that I read in the writing of it, and that there was something, because I've been filming all day, I can't remember the name of the story itself, but it was about this man who moves into a suburban community and begins to undermine everyone. I think he steals his neighbor's lawnmower and puts it in a different neighbor's garage, and you know, there's just a sense of sowing chaos and undermining the humanity and civility of his neighbors that seemed playful in the right way. You know, it's the devil with a small d instead of a capital D.
Mm, I think the story's called The Distributor, and I'm a big Matheson fan, but I haven't come across that one. I've got to check that one out. Yeah, and that's the thing that I think you say elsewhere in the book. You talk about he wants to create chaos, and he's not interested in financial gain. Really, he's just kind of this agent of chaos, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's most interesting to him is how far can he push people toward their animal nature. And as we see, you know, late in the season when he runs into Lester again and realizes that Lester has gone farther than anyone he's never pushed, you know, Malvo is willing to sacrifice this long con he's been running for months because this is more interesting to him.
Yeah. You say that there's this idea that conflict equals drama, and everyone tries to put conflict everywhere. And you say you don't really agree with this idea, especially in terms of Fargo. Can you talk a bit about how your belief that there doesn't have to be constant conflict plays out in Fargo?
Well, I think especially in a story in which there's going to be suspense and tension and violence and tragedy, that you need to give the audience some place they feel safe and a domestic reality. The way that Marge had with her husband, you know, there was never any conflict in that relationship. He brought her Arby's. And, you know, so if it's Patrick Wilson and Kristen Milioti or, you know, Molly and her dad, you know, or in season three, really it was Ray and Nikki, you give the audience a place where they can just feel safe and a relationship they root for. And then, of course, what happens is when you put Patrick Wilson in danger, people worry.
Yeah, you say that the best acting you have ever seen happened during the shooting of the last scene of season two. It was a scene with Patrick Wilson and Kirsten Dunst traveling in a car. Can you tell us a bit about this scene and how Patrick and Kirsten made it so powerful with their acting?
And somehow he rolls the bird on its side, and just before it hits the water, he jumps. 6,000 pounds of angry helicopter parts flying all around him. And somehow he makes it.
Part of it was just where we were in the story, which is the fact that, you know, Patrick Wilson, for 9.5 hours of the story, he was Gary Cooper. He didn't say that much. He was a very simple guy, as he says, you know, I've got two pairs of shoes. One in the summer and one for winter. And then when the case is finally closed and he's driving Kirsten to jail, he opens up for the first time. It's a very long monologue about his experience in Vietnam. And, you know, this gets to her, and then she opens up to him about how none of this was supposed to happen, and she knew that there was something more to life than being a wife and a mother, and she just didn't know what it was, but she was about to find it when this guy stepped out into the road, and very focused on her own tragedy, which was that this wasn't supposed to happen to her, and then Patrick says, people are dead, Peggy, and you know, what happened on Kirsten's face in the next 10 seconds, just the series of thoughts and feelings, like, you know, it's a profound gift for actors to be able to show us everything that they're thinking and feeling.
Yeah. One of the most compelling characters in season 3 is Nikki Swango, who's portrayed by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Can you tell me a bit about Nikki?
You know, Mary was such a revelation in that role. And, you know, I mean, I'd seen her work and knew what she was capable of, certainly. But you know, one of the great things about Fargo and these ensembles is that I'm often asking actors to play a range that they don't normally get in a role. So, in other words, there's a romantic relationship, there's a comedic element, there's a dramatic stakes, there's ultimately action that's required, and to move between those elements can be rare for actors in taking on roles. And I just assume if you're talented, you can do it. You can be funny. There's something interesting to the tension of someone we know comedically working dramatically.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, with Nikki, she's on parole and she's in a relationship with her parole officer. And in a more cynical story, she would be taking advantage of him or conning him, you know, just using him to make her parole easier. And we certainly entertained that idea, but ultimately it felt too cynical to me. And knowing that Ray wasn't going to make it till the end of the season, I felt, well, it's much more meaningful if she really loves him and they have this, even though they're both criminals, at the end of the day, they have this very innocent kind of love for each other that has no guile to it at all. And the other element was I really wanted her to be a strategist. And, you know, the introduction of bridge as a game in which, you know, it's a hugely complex game with a lot of probability involved of being able to play out like, you know, if these cards come up and these cards come up, that was the fun of it, was to be able to show her as a strategist when, of course, in her life, she'd never really had to strategize about anything, but just the experience of knowing that game reveals so much to us.
Whatever happens, don't let the Swedes force a Trump check again. Babe.
What?
Talk about the Wildcat Regional on Thursday. Top 3 mixed pairs, we qualify for the Upper Wisconsin Semi-Professional next month, which... top 3 in that, the sport, really opens up for us.
I don't think we can talk about season 3 without talking a little bit about the villain, VM Varga, who is played by David Thewlis. You describe him as the man who doesn't exist. What do you mean?
You know, what's interesting to me is that I think a lot about Fargo as the line that Marge has at the end of the movie where she says, and here you are, and it's a beautiful day, and for what, a little bit of money.
Hmm.
There's this element about Fargo, which is always about the things that people do for money. And so season 2 was about the death of the family business and the rise of corporate America. You know, season 3 was about where we are now with this sort of hidden money moving around the earth, this Panama Papers, offshore accounts, shell companies, all of that, and that VM Varga is a kind of Faustian figure who comes to Ewan and basically says, you're doing it wrong. It's not about profit for status. It's about hiding your money. It's about being rich and nobody knows, and that the only thing that matters is your worth.
This is a $200 suit. I wear a secondhand tie, a fly couch. Not because I can't afford first, because I'm smart. So look at you and look at me. And tell me who's the richer.
Well, I feel like this is a trick question.
There's an accounting coming, Mr. Stussy. And you know I'm right. Mongol hordes descending. What are you doing to insulate yourself and your family? You think you're rich. You've no idea what rich means.
Carrie Coon played Gloria Burgle, the police chief of Eden Valley, Minnesota. And in the third episode of season 3, Gloria travels to Los Angeles, and the whole episode takes place there. There's a whole different tone to this episode. Many critics said it was one of the best episodes of the series. Can you talk a bit about this episode and the role that it plays in the arc of season 3?
It was an interesting episode, both to write and to make, and to edit. There was a lot of conversations with MGM and FX because it was the third hour of the season when we had just gotten to know the characters and we were taking this departure with only Carrie, and Ewan's not in it. None of the other characters are in it. It's really just her journey. And ultimately, it's a story about futility and the fact that she's going to Los Angeles to try to solve her stepfather's murder, which we know she can't because we've seen what happened to him, and it's not in Los Angeles. And, you know, we have this runner with the science fiction novel that apparently he wrote as a younger man, you know, about this android who keeps saying, I can help, and then never helps anybody.
It's too late for me. You must find a way to get word back. Let them know it wasn't all for nothing.
I can help.
And the futility of that feeling ultimately pays off thematically at the end of the season. But in terms of that particular moment in the story, I think the network was very worried that we were completely stopping the momentum of the story that we'd built. And, you know, it was not cheap to go to L.A. and shoot it, so it's an exercise in futility that's also expensive.
Yeah, those are the worst kind.
Which are not words that networks like to hear.
No.
But ultimately, I think it was hugely humanizing for her, A, and then B, there was something fascinating to me about storytelling and the human experience of storytelling, which is that because there was a backstory to her stepfather being there that involved some tension, you know, if I did my job right, about halfway through the episode, the audience was going to think, I think she's going to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to think that completely irrationally because they knew in their hearts they'd seen what happened to him, and yet it's human nature when you introduce a mystery, you know, with players and suspects, that immediately the audience goes, oh, that guy did it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I thought it was fascinating for that reason as well.
Fargo is an anthology series that jumps back and forth in time. If you had to live in one of the Fargo universes that you've created, which one would you choose and why?
Well, you know, there's something really fascinating about the period stories in that you sort of have both a dramatic and comedic hindsight. You can tell a story with a straight face about how season two is built around this idea that the electric typewriter is going to be the next big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's funny to me. But
yeah.
It also leads to so much tragedy. You know, we know that the computer is right around the corner, but for these characters, you know, just plugging in a typewriter is the future. And, you know, there's something about that is, you know, exciting as a filmmaker, certainly. You know, I love all my children equally.
Of course you do. Of course you do. And they're all such very lovable children. Noah Hawley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Noah Hawley is the creator of the FX TV series Fargo. He's also the author of Fargo, This is a True Story. Find out more about Noah and Fargo at wpr.org/beta.
It was never like a fight in the schoolyard or somebody stealing my lunch money, you know. It was more of a subtle thing. It was being left out of things. It was being made fun of. It was jabs about Apu or Curry or whatever, you know, it was stuff like that.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu joins us to talk about the evolution of his career. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.